dare. Don't you dare put that thing down.
Don't put a beast down.
Show up today and Scott's like, and I'm playing this ridiculous. I mean, if anybody's watching this podcast, look at this thing. I mean, this is just, my wife joked that it's a coffee table that you could put other bases on to take pictures of. Like, it's big enough. It's like an aircraft carrier or something.
Monster.
It's just crazy. It's if you're not watching the podcast, this is a Ken Smith BT6.
How heavy is
it? It's heavy. I mean, it's not. It doesn't feel like ridiculous, but it's probably 11 pounds, maybe.
Oh,
but
so it's heavy,
but for the amount of lumber. It is. And man, yeah. I mean, I played a 6-string bass as a kid because I went from 4 to 6 and just thought that was what, you know, like that more was better. And then of course, like I had that for a while, and then I ended up selling it and going through a real renaissance when I started to play in the studio from, you know, probably, I don't know, late 20s, I guess, to now 43 when I finally come back around. It's just this cycle, dude. And I bought another 6-string bass. I mean, hanging out with you has not helped, or it has helped, depending on how you want to look at it, man. Like, you got that beautiful Manet 6, and it's cool. Ooh, like, you've always had this thing around, like, you know, just play what you want. I mean, you did that P bass thing, but then also, like, you haven't had any snark around the basses that people want to play. And I have just been in some, without naming any names, you know, I've just been in some scenes and some communities where there's definitely opinions about the type, the aesthetic of instrument. And look, I'm not tone deaf. I wouldn't bring this to the like rock blues gig, you know, okay. But it's so fun to get on an instrument like this again and just hear the, you know, hear chord shapes. That's so fun to be able to do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's really a blast. I'm just really enjoying it.
I'm enjoying geeking out on it. If anybody's wondering what we're going to be talking about today, we actually just got on and Ian was playing his Ken Smith, and I just said, hey, should we just talk about your new bass today? Or just basses? But seriously, like, sometimes Ian and I'll get on we'll hop on to record the podcast. And this has happened a few times in the past. We'll get on. We haven't spoken for, you know, in face to face in like maybe 5 days, 6 days. We'll spend 45 minutes catching up, and then we're like, shit, we can't do the podcast today because we've spent all this time talking. So I thought, in the spirit of that, we could just, you know, start off with the Smith and telling the story about, if you want to talk about some more, and then just sort of like descend into, like, I'm interested just to sort of like have a conversation about where you're at right now, projects you're thinking about doing. Let's just have a conversation and like what it's like working in SBL and like the whole thing. Let's just like project that we do in SBL. What was it like coming over to the UK? Like, I think that we should just hang out and just have a conversation.
Oh, I love it. That sounds amazing. I mean, yeah, I don't even know where to start. Where do you want to start? Because that was a lot of things, and it sparked things in my mind. And I also, too, I tried to do it on the sly, but we're being recorded. But I had a banana, like a half-eaten banana up here, and I grabbed it and tried to like move it down here. And I thought, but sometimes the screen is wider, and I think like, oh, people can't see it because it's out of frame. But if you saw my half-eaten banana.
I did an interview with Jacob Collier a few months back, and I laughed when I watched the recording of it, because in the background there's like a half-eaten slice of toast on a plate with sort of like hanging off. There's like jam on it. And it's just sort of like, and I just sort of like envisaged Jacob sitting in that music room of his, just being in there for. I think that he probably just lived in that room for.
Oh, I think
years,
so too.
Right?
Yeah.
I think you really did. Yeah. It's kind of super inspiring, isn't it? Anyway,
yeah.
Let's talk about the way. So, the Ken Smith, like, how are you feeling about it? It's a 6-string, it's a beast. Where do we even start with Ken Smith? So, tell them, sort of like, you mentioned to me just a few days ago, you were like, I've kind of always wanted a Ken Smith because I had something like it back in the day, but I couldn't afford a Smith. Because, like, Smiths, when we were younger, dude, they were the bass, weren't they?
Yes.
They were the bass.
The bass. And so we did an episode on 5- and 6-string basses, right? I mean, a couple weeks ago.
Maybe.
I think so. Oh, the time. I just feel like an old man. I'm like, I think we talked about that at some point. Yes. So I went through a big 6-string phase where, you know, I started to play the 4, and then I was like, the Carvin catalog came in the mail. And do you remember the Carvin catalog?
Oh, yeah, but
I bought an LB76, which had Koa wings, and it was neck through, and it had locking tuners and gold hardware. And it was just, I remember the day of like walking home from junior high and seeing it, like the UPS guy had just dropped it on the door, and there's a big box that said Carvin. And I remember thinking like my heart just, like, I got that adrenaline shot, like, through my body and my knees. I was glad it was still there. I was glad, I mean, because it was just saying, steal me! But, like, of any bass I ever had, I remember that sense of, like, popping open the case and opening it up. And I think I, like, screamed, you know, like, no one was home from work yet, you know, and I was just, like, me and this bass. So I had a real connection to that 6-string bass. I ended up selling it to a friend who lives in San Francisco, and he still has it. Ryan Hughes, shout out if you're listening to the pod, man. But it was a big time for me of exploration. I was writing sort of these solo compositions. I remember, I think I told you, Scott, I wrote this bass solo that I performed at my high school, and it was called Mood Swings, dude. Then slapping and tapping, and old Bob Allison, he was pumped about the bass solo.
Was he loving it?
Oh, yeah, man. And he was like, oh. And so I actually need to tell him, because for like years after that, after my high school experience, he would say, so are you writing any new bass solos on your 6-string? And then I sold the 6-string and had to tell him. And he was like, oh. And then he would say, are you going to get a new 6 anytime soon? You know, like for him, that was my identity. And it was just such a funny thing. And so it's really fun to get another one. And to your point, the Smiths, I remember buying their strings because that was the only Smith product that I could afford. And just seeing those beautiful, you know, it was the only, and just seeing those amazing instruments on the cover of the strings, you know, and in magazines. But it just seemed like all of these bass guitars to me back then just seemed like they may as well have been like, on the moon. It just felt so out of reach. Thousands and thousands of dollars. I wasn't even in the ballpark. It wasn't even a consideration. And so, you know, it's to get something like that now is really fun. But I mean, I came out to the UK and played yours, and you have a 4-string, an 80s. Yeah, the Smith. And it was so cool. And it's just a vibe. I think of all the boutique basses of that era, of that kind of like 80s era when so many boutiques started to pull, you know, proliferate?
Well, dude.
Come out.
Yeah.
When we started seeing them, I think the Smith has the most like thumbprint sound. It's a sound. And you either like love it or hate it or I don't know, but I find that I'm sort of somewhere in between. I find it fascinating. It's not the right thing for everything, but it's really cool. And you nailed it on the head, actually, when you described the Smith sound to me. And you should talk about that for a minute.
What did I say? I think I said that it's got some sort of like weird, like to your point, there is a weird Smith sound. It's like a Marmite thing. You kind of love it or you hate it. If you go onto like the old school talkbass.coms, everybody's like, everybody says the same thing. You either love it or you hate it. And, but I'm like you, I'm right in the middle, actually. It's definitely, there's something about it I love. There's maybe something that I couldn't use it all the time for because of this, because of this weird bell-like mid quality. There's something about the sound that has this bell-like quality in the mids that is very unique to a Smith. It's really hard to nail down, isn't it? I'm not even sure that if I rewound, like, you know, if I've been playing for like five years or whatever, I don't think I would have been able to hear it back then. But right now, I'm like, oh, I hear it. In fact, when you started playing, I was like, oh, that's the Smith sound. I would have been able to tell you it was a Smith sound without seeing it, I think. I'm pretty certain
I
would have been able to. And I'm not sure I'd be able to do that of any other boutique bass. Like, P bass, but any other boutique bass, I'm not sure I would have been able to be like, yeah, that's a whatever it is.
Right. I feel that way too. And, you know, you described it to me as like there was this upper mid-range, almost sort of nasal character to it. Nasal is always used in kind of, or at least I have like a bad connotation with it. Like the word nasal kind of leans like bad. Like when someone says it's nasal, one is ever like, oh, listen to that sweet, lovely nasal tone of that singer or whatever. You know, like, it's never like a good adjective, but you described it too as like fretless basses have that thing too. Like a fretless has this thing in the high mid range. A Smith has this thing in the high mid range. And what's fascinating to me about it is it's so clear. Every note on the instrument reads with such clarity and almost even like fully like a bass instrument. It definitely does. It sounds nothing like a P bass with flats. It's the opposite. Every note is articulate and bright. Yeah.
It's like a piano version of a bass, isn't it? It's just, just the clarity of the note is insane.
Yes. And so even like down low, you hear like the top of each note.
That you can hear it really like full on.
Yeah. But what I found is if you put on like some kind of effect thing, then you get just this like, because it's so clear.
I mean, it reads really well.
Yeah, it really does.
Oh, wow, you get that. Yeah, it really like accentuates that mid, doesn't it?
It kind of does. But it's so interesting. I don't know. And then if you obscure the high end with some kind of drive device. I don't know. It's just, it's cool, man. So I'm trying to figure out how to like embrace the Smith sound, but then also kind of use, because it's so sustainful, and sustainful is not a word, it sustains so well, that like using it with some effects I think is going to be really fun. So anyway, I'm down the rabbit hole, dude.
And just if anybody didn't know as well, like Ken Smith, the guy who obviously Mr. Smith, he's called Ken, they began manufacturing basses in, I think, 1978, I think, which is obviously when we were born, Ian. We were
best year ever.
Yeah, we were newborns. And they actually really brought a lot of, like, I guess, sort of like pioneered a lot of the sort of like everyday things that people see on basses now. It was Ken Smith and his team that really pioneered them. So, for instance, in 1978, they were the first people to do inlaid strap locks.
Oh, crazy.
Do you know the inlaid ones? Like Federa used, like obviously Vinnie Federa used to work for Ken Smith. And then in 1979, they did the first printed circuit board electronics.
What? I didn't know that.
1980, the first graphite inlaid neck. So when you get the strengthening beams inside a neck.
Of course, yes.
They were the first people to use a detented, which means, do you know when you actually turn the one of the knobs on the bass, it's got that kind of sort of like a notch right in the middle of it. They were the first people to use that for the balance control. So instead of having a volume for each pickup, they had a detented balance control.
What?
Yeah. 1980, first people also to use detented EQ controls. Mm. The first manufacturer to introduce a wide neck six-string bass, which they famously made for Anthony Jackson.
That's right.
Carl Thompson made the first six-string for Anthony Jackson, but it was a very slim neck. Oh. They made the first wide neck six-string.
What year was that?
1981, that was.
1981.
Also 1981, the first low B design string using 128 and 138 gauge. They were the first to actually, to introduce that string. 1983. That's insane. This is, 1983, they made the first, this is bonkers, the first wide neck five string bass in 1983. So the six string bass actually existed before the first five string, wide neck five string.
Whoa.
We've all seen taper core strings where it actually, you know, like F bass use and stuff like that. They introduced them in 1983. Quick release bridge that we all know and love now, 1983. Like, right. There's just a whole list of stuff that Ken Smith actually pioneered and brought to market. Bonkers,
dude,
right?
I'm looking down at that bass now with even more admiration. Where are you reading that? Is that like on Wiki or is that on Ken Smith?
It's on Ken Smith's site. It's on his site, yeah.
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 Man, I just think it's so fascinating when there is innovation in a space because everybody gives it up to Leo and obviously Leo Fender. I mean, the undisputed champion of, you know, he got so many things right. Everyone talks about that original 51 design. But then when there comes along manufacturers that do other things, even if they're seemingly sort of small, I mean, you read that list and that adds up to a lot of the things that now all the boutique builders are doing. Everybody's putting graphite rods in necks. Everybody uses center detents on pickup pan or, you know, EQ controls. Everybody uses some kind of, you know, quick release bridge if they're not using the standard Fender bridge. The quick release bridge, if you don't know, for anybody listening, just means there's a slot in the top that you don't actually have to pull the entire length of the string through a hole on the bridge. Yes. Or also, I remember too, taking a string off and trying to be real careful that, you know, the end of the string didn't scrape all the stuff on the way of the bass, sure. You know. Yeah. But yeah, this, you just too, lift the string out. And it's crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, they did some really cool stuff, man. Like, really cool stuff. And I think just to my earlier point as well, I think they were one of the first boutique builders to really get it right. If you look at, there was only a few back then, you know, there was obviously Alembic was around, Ken Smith, Federa came out, kind of like, if people don't understand or don't know the story, Vinnie Federa and Joey used to build basses for Ken Smith, and then they went out on their own and created Federa guitars, which is obviously Federa basses as well. But he was like one of the first boutique bass builders that really got it right. And you can see that. And if you look at like an early Smith, like for instance, the one that I've got, early 80s, it's kind of the same as they are now. Like, there's not really, in terms of construction or sound, nothing really changed. They got it right, which is very cool. Right?
It's super so cool. Yeah. I also want to give a shout out to Spector because they did a thing they did that body, that curved body. They brought some innovation to the boutique space too, and they did a reverse P. And I don't know if they were the first company to do that reverse P pickup design, but that was a big deal. And those basses landed hard in the music, I think, Scott, that you and I were loving in the 80s. You know, all of the, it seems like, you know, Alice in Chains and Queensryche, and there were a bunch of, and Skid Row, and Motley Crue. There's a bunch of like hair metal bands that I just grew up loving that were playing those instruments too, and they had a look and a vibe. But they were a boutique, but they kind of landed more in rock and roll world, which is also very cool.
Yeah. Was it Ned Steinberger that designed that body shape?
Yeah, it's some collaboration between Ned Steinberger and Stuart Spector. I think they all worked. I feel like there's some tale of like all of these guys working together in the same shop. I could be completely getting that wrong, but like Vinnie Federa, Stuart Spector, Ned Steinberger, Ken Smith. I think at one point those guys were hanging out.
Tell you what, I've been like geeking out over recently, which makes no sense. F basses. I'm an addict, dude. I'm an addict.
Dude, when I came over and played your F bass, I understood why. I was like, oh, this is really, really lovely. And something that people maybe don't know about you is that you have giant hands. I thought that I had big hands, and you had, dude, your hands are so big. And when you, that F bass is big too. Those F bass fives are big. Like the bodies are big. Yeah. Just they're like a big monster instrument. And I remember like you playing that thing. I thought, yes, this is so suiting for you. You'd love the Ken Smith 6 as well, by the way.
But I would. But I really want to try it.
Yeah. Maybe I got to bring it over next time.
But the Fs, there's something about it. Like, I really like it. And also, it really, like, it sounds like bizarre of me to say this. I'm really falling in love with 5-string basses.
This has been a road that we've been on together on the pod.
I'm really have. Do you know, like, you've lost your hair, right? Obviously.
Yes, I have.
Right. Can you remember when your hair started falling out? There was yes. definitely like a good solid 2 or 3 years of my hair falling out when, like, literally every single movie I watched on, I'd be like watching a film, I'd be like, damn, that dude's got a really great head of hair. All I could see is just like thick, luscious hair on everybody. And like, mine was kind of sort of like just like dying. I mean, like, it was just wispy. You know, like a baby's head. It was just like that, right?
And yes, I was just dude. All
this thick hair, and I could see this everywhere. Well, this is kind of what's going on with 5-strings at the minute, in that it's like every time I'm watching something and somebody hits anything that's lower than an E, I'm like, oh, I'm noticing it all the time.
That's the luscious hair.
That's the luscious hair. It's that sort of like that luscious low D or that low C sharp. It's like, oh, like, luckily, you know, it's, I'm not going to lose the 5-string like I lost my hair. But yeah, it's something I'm noticing a lot. Like, I was listening to Lala Hathaway this morning doing a cover of, what's the band? I'm going to say, hang on. Anyway, so she's playing with Robert Glasper. Hathaway.
Bass player playing a 5.
Oh, this is it. Oh, it's a cover of Everyone Wants to Rule the World. Obviously, a Tears for Fears cover. Lala Hathaway on vocals, Robert Glasper on keys, Boom Bishop on bass. What's Boom Bishop's full name?
I have no idea. I don't know. I nodded. I just did the thing where I nodded to that.
And you're like, oh,
yeah, I know who that is. I don't actually know who that is, if I'm being honest.
Oh, his name is Bernice Earl Travis II.
Come on, dude.
Yes. How amazing is that name? Bernice Earl. Let me just check. Yeah, Bernice Earl Travis II. Everybody knows him as Boom Bishop. Well, he's on this track playing with Glasper and Hathaway. And he's so tasty, dude. He's actually playing a 6-string. He's also the bass player. He's also the bass player. On, do you know that Tiny Desk concert by Yebba that I showed everybody? Yes,
okay, sure.
He's the bass player on that as well.
Killing.
Playing the 6-string. The dude's a freak, man. He's a monster. I love him so much. But, like, all that to say, that I'm really having a love affair with the low B at the minute. And every time I hear something lower than that E, I'm just like, oh. Want to run my fingers through it.
Dude, when I lost my hair, I mean, and obviously it takes a while. You don't just wake up and you're bald, right? It's this horrible, slow process.
Brutal,
but I was in the UK. I was running around. I was in Scotland going to school in Edinburgh. And I was running around with my friends in the rain, dude. And I came inside to use the bathroom and I washing my hands and I looked in the mirror and I looked like the Crypt Keeper. Do you remember Tales from the Crypt, dude? HBO. If anybody doesn't know, the Crypt Keeper is real thin, wispy hair. You saw a lot of scalp, dude. You saw a lot of scalp. And I had really long hair. I think you did too, right? You had really long hair
I did,
at one point.
Yeah.
Man, I was like the guy in high school with the really long hair. I mean,
yeah, me too, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I just, and it was on that trip that I got it cut. But I don't know about you. I went through this time of like, okay, I got it cut, and then I pushed it forward, and then I dyed it blonde, and so it wouldn't, because my hair is really dark brown, actually. My beard is red, but my hair is really almost like black, like really dark brown. And I would dye it blonde so that it wasn't as noticeable with the scalp, and then pretty soon I'm shaving it down, but not actually bicking it. I mean, it took me probably 8 years, actually, to finally, like, bick it clean. And it's, it was, whole, it's just, yeah, like,
you didn't go out and
I start. Tell my friends.
You went out,
yeah,
with a fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I did. Okay, how long was it for you from starting to lose it until you bicked it?
Oh.
And I don't know if I you think, have bick. Do you say that?
Bick it. Yeah, I actually don't it with a sort of like a razor. Right? Do you actually put
you
like...
Don't?
Do you put sort of like foam on your head and you actually like...
Oh, yeah.
You go for the full sheen. I don't do that. Maybe I should do that. I just generally get a clipper and contort myself into bizarre positions on the floor, like a, yes, some kind of sort of like yogi Kama Sutra type of vibe, right? Like I'm limbering up. But Lisa comes in, she's excited. I'm like, I'm just limbering up, baby. And actually, I'm just like in pain trying to sort of like get a tuft of hair off the back of my head. Anyway, amazing. So... Yeah, so that's how I do it, but I, you know, why not? Bit of limbering up. Anyway, so I think he started about 23. 23, yep, started getting a little, you know, a little thin, and then by, I think, 26 or 7, Lisa was cutting my hair, and she was like, dude, there's not a cut left in this. She was like, yeah, we need to shave it. I was like, okay, yeah, take it off. But up until that point, I wore a lot of hats.
Yeah,
solid.
Sure.
So yes, for like, really since the age of like 24, 25, I just wore hats all the time. Cause I,
yes.
Yeah, because especially, maybe it was because, maybe it was because I was the kid with the long hair at school, that hair was like, oh, part of my identity.
Oh, I know.
And then it's just like falling out. Can you remember? Have you ever woken up and like looked on your pillow, like when you had, yeah, hair, and you're like, that is way too much hair on my pillow? Or when you had a shower and you're like,
yes. You're just pulling out these just rings of, dude. And I mean, it took me a long time. I started to lose it when I was 19, I think.
Wow.
So really early, or 20.
My dad lost it early, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, just all the stages of denial, of trying to, like, pull my long hair, you know, kind of like a giant comb over where I've got it kind of only on one side. You know, I mean, and then I just ended up taking it off. But it took a long time. But anyway.
Would you have it back now? If you could wave a magic wand and you could just have it back, would you?
I don't know. I've actually never thought about that. There's something that I do. I've totally embraced the bald head, shaving it, hats, whatever. I'm into it.
Yeah.
But sometimes I see those dudes. It's like sometimes I hear those people playing those five strings. Sometimes I hear the six string bass, and I want those luscious locks back, dude. I want those notes down low D. Yeah. What about you?
I think I would, but I think I'd regret it. I think I'd have it back, and then after like 2 weeks, I'd be like, this is a massive ball ache. Just shave it off. Because that is a UK term, by the way, if you haven't heard that before. It begs repeating again. Ball ache.
Oh, thank you. Yes, we needed it again.
And yeah, because like I look at other people's hair, and like I'm looking at Josh's now. Josh Paul is still up on my screen. He's got like lots of like cool do's and stuff.
Oh yeah,
he's got it spiky, baby. And it's like, do you know what? I'm not sure. I'm not the grooming type. I'm just not. And I think it's I'm kind of made to be bald. I'm made to be bald. I can kind of make myself look cool because I've got, you know, cool hats, whatever. Accessories, you know, whatever, and glasses. You know, I've got to put something on my face. I actually think that even if I didn't wear glasses, I might wear them anyway, just to have something on my head. Because dude, otherwise, I just look like a massive baked bean. You know,
take them off.
Yeah, look, like, yeah, look.
Dude, are we doing it? Okay, hold on.
Look at it. Yeah, just
look at it. Dude, I've got the hat line. I've got the hat line right now.
It's just grim, isn't it? Oh, it's grim. Do you know what? I had another grim thought this morning. I was lying in bed with my daughter this morning, and we were chatting. And she gave me a real kick in the nuts, and she said, not a literal kick in the nuts, but she said, is Granny younger than you, Daddy, or older than you? I was like, oh!
like your mom?
yeah, but it's actually Lisa's mom. And I was like, she's 20 years older than me. And she went, whoa, I thought you were around the same age. I was like, great. And then as I was picking my ego off the floor and trying to scoop it up, then she said, well, how old's granddad? I said, well, granddad's actually a lot older than granny. He's 74. And she went, wow. And she was like, how much older than you is that? And I was like, 30 years. She went, wow. And then she got a big old foot out and kicked me in the balls again. And she said, does that mean that you are going to be 74 in 30 years?
Yes, it does, sweetheart. Like, and thank you for that.
Yeah, and my ego just slammed down on the floor. Dude, we're going to be mid-70s in 30 years.
Dude, it's time to buy all the bases. It's time to play all the musics. It's time to build all the bass empires.
It's weird, right? It's weird thinking about it like that, you know? Like,
yes, it
74.
Is.
Like, I look at my dad and he's... Okay, without saying anything bad about my dad, I'm not looking forward to being 74. He's not kind of like jogging. he's 74 and he looks 74. He looks sort of like, a bit knackered, you know. And looks a bit knackered. Yes. Sorry, Dad.
Yeah.
And man, 74. And I think about like, it made me think, like, I think about this a lot anyway, but like after that experience when she just sort of like laid it out and she was like, oh, so you'll be 74 in 30 years time. I started thinking to myself, well, when, like, do we just go like full bore until till we can't do it anymore? And then we're just like, and like can't work or whatever. Like, is there a time in your life where you just sort of like, not don't do anything, but where you sort of like chill out a little bit more? I'm not sure. Like, I will say that I don't think, like, retirement, I think when my dad retired, it was like really bad for him. It was really bad. I think that for him, and I think, and I've heard this for a lot of other people as well, that it's actually, you know, a lot of the time when people get to that later stage of life, whether it be sort of like mid-50s to 65, they're looking forward to retiring. When my dad retired, it was really crap for him. I think he sort of like felt disconnected from the friends he'd built up. I think that he kind of like lost purpose in some way. And I think that I would do the same. So I'm not a huge believer of, like, I'm absolutely not looking forward to, oh, I can't wait till I'm 65 so I can retire. I just think, for me, that's bullshit. But, you know, at the same time, I'm like, but I don't want to work like 10-hour day. I work 10 hours a day usually. I don't want to work 10 hours a day until I'm sort of like, you know, I can't work anymore.
I mean, that's the thing, right? You don't, I feel that same way. I never want to retire, but I want to financially be able to retire. That's the wrong way to say it. I want to not have to work because I'm desperate for money until I'm 85 years old. You know, but still, I always want to do something with music. Whenever I think about this, first of all, it's scary as fuck.
Yeah.
So there's that.
Yeah.
But also, I think about Steve Swallow. And Steve Swallow, I know that you love Steve Swallow, and so do I.
Like, massive fan, yeah.
as a bass player. He's a jazz bass player. Just a brief thing on Steve. Jazz bass player, played upright at first and then played an electric bass. I believe at first it was a Gibson hollow body, an EB2, that he fell in love with. And he went, uh-oh, this is going to make my life really difficult. Because he still wanted to play jazz music, but he wanted to do it on electric bass. And anyway, he's probably in his... I'm gonna guess that he's in his 70s now. He's, I don't know, 81. Fact checker. What?
81.
He's 81?
Yeah.
Well, just look Steve at it Swallow now. Is still playing and still with it and vibrant and creative and cool.
He's and on tour now. I'm looking now. I'm just like,
he's on tour.
He's on tour. Incredible. Yeah.
And he said a thing once where people, people asked him, somebody asked him like, oh, you know, how is your playing in what, you know, later in your life, like when you're in your 70s or 80s, how does it feel? And he said something that I'll never forget. He said, I feel like I don't have the same level of facility. I'm not playing as fast as I used to, but I think my bass playing is getting more useful. That's the word he used.
That's interesting.
I think my bass playing is getting more useful. He's like, I'm making better choices. I'm not focused as much on me. I'm focused on doing the things that I can do. And I'm actually finding that that's supporting the ensemble even better. And that's bringing me a lot of joy as a result.
Yeah,
and I thought, God damn, that's cool. It's so cool.
It really
cool.
is, isn't it? Yeah. It's really, really cool. Yeah. Because I guess that you lose facility, don't you? As you get older. Like, sure. Luckily, we're not there yet, but I wonder when that starts happening. I mean, I'm assuming it's sort of like 60s, maybe, when your hands start slowing down. Even though, like, there's some monster bass players that are sort of like older, right? It's sort of like, is John Patitucci in his 60s? Maybe not, actually.
I don't know.
I'm trying to think of like a bass player who's a monster and in their 60s. Let's have a look.
I mean, I feel like my facility is not, it could just. Maybe it's an age, but maybe it's just that I'm not focusing on the same things anymore. But I used to be faster, and
I think I did, but
like a
you
know.
I think that for me, probably yourself as well. I think it's more to do with just that we're probably not doing that thing anymore. John's actually 62. Ian and I had a conversation with John a few days ago, and we can happily report that he's absolutely burning.
John Patitucci, dude, shows up on that Zoom call, and he's like, and we're like, wow! It was so great.
He's so cool, man. I find John so inspiring. He's just like, he's actually got exactly what Ricky Minor had. I've had sort of like, I've hung out with sort of like a few musicians that I guess that I didn't really know what to expect because they were kind of legendary status and were, you know, a generation or two older than me, right? They were sort of like this upper echelon of player, you know, and people are like, kind of, And the first time, it's the first time I met Ricky Minor, who, if nobody knows Ricky Minor, well, loads of people will, but if you don't know who Ricky Minor is, he was like musical director for Whitney Houston, but then he went on to do American Idol as the musical director, and he's also worked with like Ray Charles and sort of like all of these huge artists, right?
He was in the Jay Leno house band as well. I remember that. Yeah, he was on Late Night for a long time. Yep.
He's just a super cool guy. Anyway, so, and I talked to Ricky, and he was like just so pro. He was like he was like, do you know what he called people that he worked with? His clients. I was like, this guy's for real. He's like, and I was in his studio. His studio is on a film set actually in LA. So I was in LA in Ricky's studio. This sounds sort of like unbelievable to speak about, but it really did happen. Man, I should have taken some more pictures or something like that. Anyway, honestly, I was here. And he was super pro. He's talking about his clients and stuff. And then after the interview, he was like, oh, should we go and check out some basses? I've got my basses through here. Well, when he got among the basses, he suddenly turned into like a 16-year-old kid.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, he was so enthusiastic. He was so geeky about it. He was like, oh, this bass and that bass. And I was like, this is why he's fucking awesome. Because yes. he's just full of that 16-year-old spirit that he just wants to geek out. He got out the Ken Smith, actually, to bring it right back to the top of our conversation. He got out the 5-string Ken Smith that recorded I Will Always Love You with Whitney Houston, her biggest hit. Right, that was the bass on that hit. So I played that. It was a monster bass. And, yes. And anyway, all to say that John Patitucci reminds me very much in that same way as Ricky Minor is, like, he's just like that 15 or 16-year-old character who's just super in love with what he does. And he's just so passionate about it. And he wants to talk about it. And he's just, I just love it. I love people like that. I think it's really inspiring.
And I talked to him about the record of his that impacted me the most was called Heart of the Bass, which was early 90s, 91 or 92. And he just went, oh, like, I don't know. I never know how artists are going to react when you talk about an album that was made ages ago, decades ago.
Like, if
they're going to feel some way about it, or they, sometimes I feel like artists have this thing where they want to talk about their new thing, but he just said, oh, thank you, and was like, oh, and the people that helped out on this record, and I thought that, I mean, he just had all of this love and for that era, and that was really inspiring to me, actually, versus like, oh, thanks, man, but oh, you should hear the new stuff I'm doing. You know, like
That thing is never.
So many artists have that of like, oh yeah, that was when I didn't have the right bass or the you know, the stuff sounded bad, or you know, like when someone connects with something, it's so cool when artists say, oh yeah, that was a great period in my life. But I mean, he's had these just incredible periods of just incredible creativity and monster musicianship on both the electric and upright bass. And sometimes I forget that he is such a beast on upright as well. It's insanity.
It's insanity, isn't it? Yeah, it really is. Yeah. I do. Do you know when we're talking about like John, there's so much love for him, isn't there? Same thing about like, you know, Ricky, same thing when we're talking about Gary Willis, same thing about all of these kind of, these guys that have just created so much art, so much great music over decades and decades. Who do you think? I think that we're in some sort of like weird transition period at the minute. Like, I don't think that currently any of the new guys, I'm not sure, will be like John Patitucci. I don't think anybody is going to be sitting there talking about the new, I mean, anybody right now, because the reason why we talk about, and this is like, I'd love for you to push back if you've got another kind of sort of like take on it. But I think the reason why we love John, we love Gary, we love these players so much is because they've been doing it for so, so long. And we've kind of sort of like followed their entire careers, and they've like emotionally kind of affected us, right, with how they perform and the music that they create. And I think currently I'm not sure that there's any, like, maybe I do think we're in a transition period. I think that there will be another something, you know, new in terms of how the music industry from an economical standpoint actually functions in the future. We've talked about starting a label before, you know, all of that, right? I'm into all that. But right now, where we are right now, do you think there's any kind of like bass heroes like there used to be, like the Gary Willis, like the John Patitucci? Do you think that they exist? Or do you think any of the characters that are around, like the up and comers right now? Or do you think, for instance, that maybe Michael League was the last kind of layer of bass hero?
I think that I know what you mean. I think it's some like, because I want to push back on it, but we're both the same age, and I'm like, yeah, there's no more Patitucci's and there's no more, but I do, a couple people came to mind. The two people that came to mind for me, which I'm going to be so excited to watch them grow, and I'm actually just really happy to be alive when they're thriving and maybe just starting out, is Thundercat and Mono Neon.
Yes. Yes.
Those two players are like, they could do anything. I feel like the canvas is wide open. They could make solo records where they're playing bass and singing. And because they're both, the interesting thing about both of those dudes is they're both singers also. And that is so rare, right? So that's a different vibe. They're like singer-songwriters.
I think you're right, actually, about Mono, in terms of like them being kind of sort of like that.
Yes.
That kind of like legendary status in a few years, yeah. Well, kind of. Like,
I mean,
they kind of are anyway, right?
But for sure, yeah. For sure. And Thundercat, like when I saw him on Star Wars, I was like, "What?" Like when he was in,
yeah, John Book of Boba Fett. You were in Star Wars, John. Come on,
yeah, yes, Stu right. Ham, you weren't in Star Wars.
Yeah. Oh, can you imagine? Oh, what? I'd be so freaking cool if, like, you know, if it turned around that's in that scene and it was like Thundercat. And we were like, whoa. I can remember seeing him and I'm like, holy crap, it's Thundercat. Can you imagine that if it sort of like panned out and he was like John and John Patucci and Stu Happy? I'd be just like, yeah!
Dude, I died. And Emily was like, what's the big deal? I'm like, that's Thundercat. She's like, who's Thundercat? You know? And it's like, it's just so funny. Like, lest we forget that the base Friends community...
Yes.
Good. Yes. Excellent reference. You know, like, lest we forget that our little niche in the world is very small compared to A-list celebrity gossip or whatever. You know, seeing Thundercat in something, like, yeah. I feel like, you know, it's such a big deal for us, but in terms of the radar, it's like, zoop, on the. It's just a
yeah,
blip.
Yeah.
It's just
a
blip. I was like, this is going to be headline news, you know, and it isn't.
I wonder how many people, like, are fans of Thundercat, but do have no clue of who Panthera or Cheetah are.
Yeah.
Or Tigra, dude. Tigra. Who was your favorite?
The Thundercats?
Yeah, mine was Panthera.
Honestly, I wish I could tell you. I don't know that. I mean, I don't know that cartoon as well
what?
As you do.
Yes, dude. Yes.
What?
I got some learning to do.
You didn't watch Thundercats.
They all assembled into a thing, right?
Thundercats,
was
I
that,
go.
Was that Voltron?
That's Voltron, dude.
Damn it. I thought I was going to fool you, dude. I thought I was going to sneak it in. I don't really know Thundercats. I was like, Panthera, yeah. Tigra, yeah. I was like, Leopardra, yeah.
So you don't know who Snarf is? No, Snarf.
No,
no.
I don't know Snarf. I'm sorry, I don't. Oh, I thought I could sneak the cool guy by you, but no dice. You're like, who's your favorite Thundercat? And I thought, oh shit, here we go.
What? Was it not big in the States?
Well, it may have been, but I was a He-Man guy. I mean, Saturday morning cartoons. I was Masters of the Universe, G.I. Joe. Transformers, but I know, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. Like,
no Thundercats.
No. Well, I mean, at least not in my memory.
I don't think I've ever been as confused. Yeah, like, it was cool, man. Thundercats,
yeah,
it was
kind
of sort of like very similar to He-Man. It was around that same time. Oh, anyway. If anybody is a big fan of Thundercat, the bass player, make sure that you check out Thundercats with Cheetah, Lion-O. Lion-O was like Optimus Prime. So Lion-O's cool. Optimus Prime, and then he's got his like little troop of Panther and Cheetah and Tigra, I think Snarf was there, sort of like, Snarf was like, what's that small transformer with the kind that turns into a scooter?
Oh.
Squeaks.
Did you even
watch Transformers?
Yeah, man. But I don't remember Squeaks.
Right, Snarf is like Squeaks for Transformers. Maybe, yeah.
Dude.
Well, it's been a great conversation, man. We should do more like this. If you guys... I'm not sure that you've got any way of telling us, but maybe sort of like DM us on IG or something like that, and let us know if you like this episode of Ian and I going on sort of like an exploratory ramble about all things bass and, you know, modern culture and cartoons and all of that stuff. But yeah, let us know, because I've actually really enjoyed this conversation.
It's so fun. And I've got some research to do. I got to get my Thundercat. I got to get my Thundercat vocabulary tuned up.
That's the tattoo that Thundercat has got on his hand. That's the Thundercat symbol, dude.
Yes. Now, I did know that. Before we wrap, let me say one thing about Thundercat, the bass player, the artiste, the singer-songwriter. Thundercat is a great example of somebody who is not ashamed to like what they like. I think my favorite thing about Thundercat, apart from his amazing songwriting and playing and sound and just like genre bending, headwear, fashion sense.
He's taken to the next level.
Dude, yes.
We need to level up.
You're right about that. I'm like, but what about my Montana hat? Yeah. I think my favorite thing, I heard an interview, maybe it was on Song Exploder, but it was on a podcast where someone was asking him about the artists that he loved the most. And he talked about composers. And I thought, oh, he talked about composers. And I thought, yes, he's going to talk about Beethoven and Chopin and Liszt and Bach. But no, he talked about video game composers. Yeah, and he talked about, and I wish that I could bring up the name of the original, like, NES, you know, early 80s Nintendo, the Japanese man that wrote and scored a bunch of those video games, is a famous name that I can't pull up right now. But Thundercat talked about him.
Is it Koji Kondo?
Maybe. I'm not going to be like, yeah, because I don't know. But he just, it was the first time that I'd heard anyone talk about video game music like it was on the same level or elevated even above other art forms. I'd always heard people kind of say like, oh, video game music, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of cool, but I always got a vibe from people that it was perceived as like lesser than. Yeah, and he was saying it's his favorite music. And I thought, that is so cool to just admit. I feel like a lot of times people don't admit the things they love and the things they like and really go all in on what they actually really feel right here. And Thundercat, to me, is the most inspiring in that regard of his artistry. The things he loves, he goes in hard. Dragon Ball Z, he goes in. Star Wars, he goes in. He's in it, you know.
He's in it, isn't it? Yeah.
Video game composers. So it's, that's so influential. And that actually was a big influence on me in terms of like, yeah, the sounds that I want to make and the music that I want to make, how I play on records, if it's the right vibe, really embracing the things that I like and the sounds that I like. That was a lot due to Thundercat just like planting that flag in the ground.
Yeah, like some of them composers are really great, actually. Like, like I didn't get into it until much later, but it was, I think, kind of sort of like late 20s. I started really getting into, it was actually with sort of like, there was a cross-section of my focal dystonia and like video game composition or composers. Yeah. And film composers, to be honest, because I was like, I thought I wasn't going to be able to play anymore. So I was like, well, I might be able to sort of like compose for TV and stuff like that, whatever film. So I started like researching it, got really, really into it. The guy that I kept on coming back to, he's actually a film composer, Danny Elfman. I love Danny Elfman.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man, what a beast.
Oh, me too.
I've got a really, really funny story about Danny Elfman, Abbey Road, and an explosive poo. We'll talk about it on another episode. But just before we go any further...
What a cliffhanger.
It wasn't Danny Elfman's explosive poo. But, yeah, So let's talk about the next episode, right? Danny Elfman, Abbey Road Studios, and an explosive poo.
That's the title of the next podcast.
Yeah, I might have told you that story, but we'll tell the guys on the podcast. Yeah, I have told you. Anyway, guys, thanks so much for listening. Let us know if you enjoyed the episode. DM us on IG or whatever. And, we'll see you next time. Take it easy.
Cheers, everybody.